am the Greek goddess Harmonia. By the miracle of your technology, I can speak to you from behind the veil. Come sit with me for a few minutes for another episode of The Golden Thread. Well, hello there. I'm so glad you came back. Last time, we sat together with Michael Servetus, a brilliant, restless man who couldn't stop himself from saying true things in dangerous places. You remember how that ended? The fire, the certainty of other men, the terrible cost of being right too loudly in the wrong century. I've been thinking about him since, and I found myself wanting to bring you somewhere different today, not away from suffering. I'm afraid we can't go there, not in any honest telling of the human story, but toward a different kind of answer to it. Today I want to tell you about a man who was also crushed by a system that had no patience for his kind, who was imprisoned and broken in ways I won't rush past, who had every reason the world could offer to become hard and hollow and cold. He didn't. In fact, and I'm still a little amazed by this, and I've had a long time to think about it, he came out the other side somehow more himself than when he went in. His name was Father John. And I was there the day a room full of men learned, to their considerable embarrassment, that they had badly misjudged what they were dealing with. I want to take you to a room. It isn't much of a room. Soviet offices rarely were. A table, some chairs, fluorescent light the color of old snow, the smell of damp wool and cigarettes, and the particular kind of fear that soaks into walls over years and never quite leaves. The year is somewhere in the early 1950s. Father John has already been in the camps for a while by now. I won't linger on what that meant, but I will tell you this much, because you need to know it to understand what happens next. They had broken every finger on his hands, deliberately, one by one. The men whose job it was to break people were good at their job, and yet... Here he is, brought into this room for what the interrogators called a confrontation. They had a surprise prepared for him, a fellow priest, a man Father John had stood beside at the altar, whose voice he knew in the liturgy, whose hands he had watched raise the chalice in the half-dark of early morning services. This man had informed on him, had given him to the state, was the reason Father John was here at all. The interrogators knew what betrayal does to a person. They had seen it many times. They were expecting rage, or tears, or the cold satisfaction of accusation finally spoken aloud. Any of those would have been useful. Any of those would have been normal. Father John walked into the room. He saw his brother priest. His face lit up. He threw his arms around him. The informer fainted. I was there. I have walked through centuries of human cruelty and human nobility and every tangled thing in between. I thought I knew the range of what a person could do in a moment like that. I was not prepared for this. The confrontation did not go as planned. The interrogators had built a careful machine, and a man full of love had walked into it and simply embraced it. There was nothing left for the machine to do. I have thought about that room for a long time. I think I will keep thinking about it. Let me tell you who he was before that room, because it matters. Ivan Mikhailovich Krestiankin was born in 1910 in the old Russian city of Oryol, a place of onion domes and river mist and the particular unhurried rhythms of provincial Orthodox life. He was the eighth child in his family, eight children. His mother, Elizaveta, ran a household full of noise and prayer and the ordinary sacred chaos of a large family trying to stay fed and faithful in a world that was already beginning to shake. He was named Ivan, John, in honor of St. John of the Desert. A small sign, maybe, or maybe not so small. The desert fathers were men who went into emptiness and came back carrying something. That pattern would repeat. From the time he was very young, the church was simply where he belonged. Not as obligation, not as habit, as home. He served as an altar boy, then as a reader, then deeper and deeper into the life of the liturgy, the chanting, the incense, the ancient words worn smooth by centuries of mouths. He loved it the way some people love music. It was the language he thought in. And the world around him was coming apart. The revolution had already happened by the time Father John was old enough to understand it. The Bolsheviks had no patience for God. Churches were being closed, converted to warehouses and factories and cinemas. Priests were being arrested, exiled, shot. The seminaries were shuttered, the monasteries emptied. The state was conducting what you might call a deliberate forgetting, a systematic effort to cut the next generation off from everything that had come before. Father John watched all of this and kept going. He was ordained a priest in 1945, just as the war was ending and the country was exhausted and the repressions were already beginning again under Stalin's long, cold shadow. He served in parishes around Moscow and then in the Ryazan region. Quietly, faithfully, one soul at a time. He had a gift for it. People found him and didn't want to leave. Something about him settled the air around him. The state noticed. In 1950, he was arrested. The charge, as these charges often were, was vague and unanswerable. Anti-Soviet agitation. What it meant, translated plainly, was you are a priest and you are still doing it. He was sentenced to 8 years in the labor camps. He served five before his release in 1955. He came back. He eventually made his way to the Skov Caves Monastery, the Skovo Pechersky, carved into a hillside near the Estonian border, a monastery so old and so stubborn that even the Soviet authorities had never quite managed to close it entirely. A small surviving ember. Father John settled there and stayed for the rest of his life. He died in 2006. He was 95 years old. 95. After everything, I want you to understand what the Soviet project was actually trying to do, because it wasn't simply cruelty, though it was certainly that. It was a theory. The theory went like this. Religion is a transmission. It doesn't live in books or buildings, not really. It lives in people, in the elder who sits with the frightened young man at 3 a.m, in the grandmother who teaches her granddaughter how to cross herself, in the priest whose presence in the room changes the quality of the air. If you can remove those people, arrest them, exile them, break them, make an example of them, the transmission stops. The next generation grows up in the silence and doesn't know what it's missing. The thing dies not with a fight, but with a forgetting. It was, I have to admit, not a stupid theory. What it failed to account for was Father John. There is a tradition in Orthodox Christianity, very old, older than Russia itself, called the Starets, the spiritual elder. Not a bishop with institutional authority, not a theologian with arguments, simply a person who has gone deep enough into prayer and suffering and love that other souls are drawn to them the way cold hands are drawn to a fire. Father John was that. He had been stripped of everything the state could strip, his freedom, his health, the use of his hands, any protection. And yet people kept coming to him, ordinary parishioners with nowhere else to turn, theologians, the patriarchs of Russia, writers, eventually even Vladimir Putin. They traveled to a small monastery carved into a hillside near the Estonian border to sit with an old man in a monk's cell. They came because something in him was undiminished. He listened. He prayed with people. He wrote letters, thousands of letters to people he would never meet in person, answering questions about grief and marriage and doubt and vocation, with the same unhurried attention he gave to the person sitting across from him. He respected the people who came to him enough to tell them the truth. And he respected them enough to let them make their own choices, even the bad ones, without making them feel his disappointment as a weight they had to carry. That last part is rarer than it sounds. In a country where authority had spent decades using shame and fear as instruments of control, Father John offered something almost unrecognizable. He treated the people who came to him as capable adults in possession of their own souls. He did not need them to be broken to be useful to them. He did not need their gratitude. He did not need anything from them at all. People came from everywhere, ordinary parishioners who had nowhere else to turn, theologians with questions he answered better than they expected. The patriarchs of Russia came, writers came. Eventually, improbably, Vladimir Putin came. They all came for the same thing. Not information, not instruction, not even comfort, exactly. They came because something in him was undiminished. And in a world designed to diminish, that was the most extraordinary thing imaginable. That, I think, is what they felt when they walked into his cell. Not the presence of someone who wanted something from them. The presence of someone who was simply full, complete. Asking nothing, offering everything. And they could not get enough of it. I have watched empires try to kill ideas before. It almost never works the way they plan. You can burn a library. You can silence a press. You can empty a monastery and padlock the doors and paint over the frescoes and turn the nave into a grain storage facility. I have seen all of that done, more times than I care to count, to more traditions than I will name today. What you cannot do, and this is the part the theorists always seem to miss, is imprison a person's way of being in the world. Father John walked out of the gulag and went back to being Father John. The state had taken 5 years of his life and the full use of his hands and had gotten, in return, absolutely nothing. He was not diminished, he was not redirected, he was not useful to them in any of the ways broken men become useful. He simply went back to his work, one soul at a time, one letter at a time, in a monastery on a hillside that had stubbornly refused to disappear. And the transmission continued. His spiritual children carried what they had received from him out into the world. Archimandrite Tikhon Shevkunov, one of the most prominent figures in the contemporary Russian Orthodox Church, wrote a memoir called Everyday Saints that brought Father John's world to millions of readers who had never heard of the Pskov Caves Monastery. The book sold more copies in Russia than any book since the Soviet collapse. People recognized something in it. Something they had been hungry for without knowing quite what to call it. What Father John added to the world's spiritual imagination is not easy to summarize in a sentence, but I will try. He demonstrated that wholeness is not the reward for an easy life. It is available in the hardest one, that a person can go through the worst that institutional cruelty has to offer and come out the other side not merely intact, but somehow enlarged, more capable of love, not less. More interested in other people, not less. The broken fingers become the hands that blessed thousands. That is not a metaphor. That is what happened. I want to say something carefully here because I have seen this pattern before and it matters. The logic that was used against Father John, sever the transmission, silence the elders, separate the children from the carriers of living memory, is not unique to Soviet Russia. I have watched it applied to other peoples on other continents in other languages. To indigenous communities whose children were taken from their grandmothers and placed in institutions designed to make them forget. The uniforms were different. The paperwork was different. The intent was the same. And in those communities, too, the thread held. Not always. Not without devastating loss. But it held because the tradition had gone into persons rather than institutions, into grandmothers who kept the language alive in kitchens, into elders who remembered the songs, into the same stubborn human refusal to be entirely unmade. Father John understood something about that kind of survival, not as theory, as lived experience. You do not survive by becoming what they wanted you to become. You survive by remaining as completely as possible yourself. I want to be honest with you about something. I have watched a great many things be destroyed. Not damaged, not disrupted, destroyed. Languages that were spoken for 10,000 years and are now silent forever. Ceremonies that required a living chain of transmission. Grandmother to grandchild, elder to initiate. And when that chain was broken deliberately, institutionally, the knowledge did not wait patiently to be recovered. It went with the people who carried it. The gulag took priests who knew things no book had ever recorded. The residential schools took children and returned strangers. And what was lost in that exchange cannot be itemized, because the people who would have known what to itemize were the ones who were lost. I am not going to tell you that the essence survived and just needs to be found again. That is a comforting story, and it is not always true. What I'm going to tell you is what I saw in that Soviet office, and what I have seen in other places, in other times, among other peoples who were told that what they were was no longer permitted. I saw people who refused to let the destruction be the final word, not by pretending it hadn't happened, not by minimizing what was taken, but by picking up what remained, which was sometimes very little. And deciding that it was enough to move forward with, not backward, forward, into a future that would have to be built new, because the old one was gone and was not coming back. That is not the same as recovery. I want to be clear about that. Recovery implies return. There is no return. Father John did not get his fingers unbroken. The languages do not unsilence themselves. The children do not come back from the schools as the people they would have been. The loss is real and it is permanent. And anyone who tells you otherwise is not your friend. But here is what I have also seen. I have seen what happens when the descendants of those who survived and the descendants of those who did the destroying find themselves standing on the same ground on this side of the trauma, looking at the same future. That moment, that specific, uncomfortable, necessary moment, is where everything either calcifies into permanent opposition or begins slowly and imperfectly to become something new. Father John knew both kinds of people. The man who betrayed him was in that room, and Father John did not need him to undo what he had done before he could be glad to see him. He did not need the accounting to be settled before he could open his arms. He was not naive about what had happened. He simply refused to let what had happened be more important than what could happen next. That is what I want to leave with you today. Not that the wounds weren't real. Not that the losses weren't catastrophic, but that the people standing here now, on whichever side of history they were born into, are not only their wounds, are not only their guilt, are not only what was done to them or what was done in their name. We are also what we choose to carry forward, and we do not have to carry it alone. We were never meant to. So let me ask you something, not about Father John, about you. You are standing somewhere right now, in your kitchen, on a bus, walking a road you have walked 100 times, and you are carrying something. Everyone is. Some of us carry the memory of what was taken from our people. Some of us carry the uncomfortable knowledge of what was taken by ours. Most of us, if we are honest, carry some complicated mixture of both, because history is long, and none of our families arrived at this moment by a simple road. And here is what I have learned. Watching as long as I have watched, anger knows what it is against. It is very clear about that. Guilt knows what it owes. It keeps careful accounts, but neither of them knows how to build anything. They are not designed for it. They are designed to look backward, to the wound, to the wrong, to the debt that cannot be fully paid. And a person or a people who can only look backward will stand in the same place forever, very certain of their grievance, going nowhere. Father John did not go nowhere. He went forward into a future that had no obligation to be kind to him, with hands that had been deliberately broken, carrying a faith that the state had spent decades trying to erase. He went forward not because the past didn't matter, but because the future needed him more than the past did. And he went forward toward people, all of them, without auditing their histories before deciding whether they deserved his attention. That is the invitation I want to leave with you today, not to forget. Never to forget. The forgetting is its own betrayal of the people who suffered. But to consider, just consider whether the future you want can actually be built out of the materials of anger and guilt. Whether the world you are hoping for can be constructed by people who are still primarily defined by what divides them. I don't think it can. I have never seen it done that way. What I have seen in the rarest and most luminous moments of this long human story is people who chose to stand together on the ground of what they shared rather than the ground of what separated them. Not pretending the separation wasn't real, not papering over the wound with false cheerfulness, but deciding deliberately that hope was a more useful foundation than grievance, that fellowship was a more powerful force than either anger or guilt. That takes courage. More courage sometimes than the original endurance did. Father John had it. I have seen others have it. I believe you can have it too. The future will not build itself, but it can be built. And it will be built by people who are willing to stand next to someone who carries a different piece of the story and say, I see what you are carrying. I am carrying something too. Let's see what we can make together. That is not weakness. That is the bravest thing I know. Before I let you go, I want to tell you where we are heading next. There was a young Japanese monk in the 13th century who became convinced that something was missing. Not from his life exactly. He was devoted, disciplined, serious about his practice in ways that put most of his contemporaries to shame. But he had a question that wouldn't leave him alone. A question about the nature of awakening, and whether it was something you achieved or something you already were. And the teachers around him couldn't answer it to his satisfaction. So he did what people with unanswerable questions sometimes do. He got on a boat. He sailed across the sea to China, A journey that was genuinely dangerous, genuinely uncertain, genuinely the kind of thing that reasonable people advised against. He spent years there, studying, searching, sitting in silence until the silence said something back. And then he came home. He came home carrying something he couldn't quite put into words, which is perhaps why he spent the rest of his life writing some of the most beautiful and difficult prose in the history of Japanese literature, trying to put it into words anyway. His name was Dogen, and I cannot wait to tell you about him. But for now, come back to this room, come back to Father John, and that Soviet office, and the man who fainted when he expected recrimination and received an embrace instead. I have told you a lot of hard things today about what gets destroyed and what cannot be recovered, and the long, difficult work of building something new out of the rubble of what was taken. I meant all of it. But I want to leave you with the image I started with, because I think it is the truest thing I have to offer. A man walked into a room with broken hands and a full heart. The machinery of cruelty was waiting for him, and he simply didn't give it anything to work with. Not because he was unaware of what had been done to him, but because he had decided, somewhere deep and unshakable, that love was a more interesting response than hatred. That the person in front of him mattered more than the accounting between them. That the future, even his future, even after everything, was worth showing up for with his whole self. That is the thread. Running through Father John's life, through the stubborn survival of every people who were told that what they were was no longer permitted, through every moment in history when someone chose to build rather than destroy, it has never broken. Not once. In all the time I have been watching, hold on to it. Much love. I am Harmonia. Oh, thank you for listening, dear one. If this episode meant something to you, I'd love it if you'd leave a 5-star rating. It helps more people find their way here. And if you subscribe, you will never miss a thread, and share this story with someone you love. One more thing, my friend, look in your episode notes. There's a link there that leads back to our little community. Leave a comment. I promise. I read every one. This podcast sails out to you from Red Buoy Media, LLC. The stories we share are licensed under Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, Share Alike 4.0 International. That means you can pass them along, remix them, and even argue with them. Just give us credit, don't try to sell them, and share responsibly. Thanks for listening, friend. Until our next adventure.